This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 89 was recorded November 16th, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. HedgEye founder Keith McCullough joins me as this week's feature interview guest. Keith continues to make a bullish argument for the stock market, something we've been looking for to contrast the many bearish guests that we've had on the program. We'll discuss HedgEye's three core macro themes for the fourth quarter, why they favor a long-short equity strategy, and which sectors they believe will outperform. Keith sent us a slide deck, which we'll reference throughout the interview. Registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you're not yet registered, just go to macrovoices.com and look for the Looking for the Download button just above Keith's picture on our homepage. Be sure to stay tuned after the feature interview for our post-game segment, in which Patrick and I will discuss a very interesting piece written by J.P. Morgan's Jan Lowey.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, you know, I was thinking all week of talking about how the S&P 500 has begun some sort of a market correction and where it was going to go. But no sooner did the today roll around and we had this huge rebound where the S&P 500 recovered almost the entire loss, heading almost to a high of 2590, now trading around this 2584 level. What's your thinking here on the S&P 500?
Well, Patrick, when we get to the interview with Keith McCullough, you'll hear we recorded this interview at probably the lows on Wednesday, and everybody was saying, oh my gosh, it's the beginning of the end. And Keith and I joked about it because I don't see any reason to think that now is the time. Now, I definitely think that we're overdue for a major, major market correction, but I don't see any signals to tell me that it's imminent. So, you know, there's a lot of people that are saying this is the big one. I ask, how do they know that? And have they made similar predictions in the past that didn't pan out? And I think in most cases they did. So I don't think it's over yet. I think we are probably, you know, unfortunately, I was busy with other things. I wish instead of taping the interview with Keith yesterday that I had put on that ratio call spread trade that you've talked about, because I do think that there's plenty more upside in this market, probably. But boy, if there's ever been a time to do it with options so you protect your downside, the people who are calling for a crash are going to be proven right eventually. I just don't think it's time yet. You don't want to be exposed to that risk. Use options in order to participate in the upside and not take the downside risk.
All right, let's move on to the U.S. dollar, which obviously had several strong weeks to the upside. But in the last few days, we've seen the dollar index giving a chunk of that back. We hit a high near 95, and now we've pulled back to the low 93 area. We're trading right now at 93.80. What's your thinking here on the dollar?
Yeah, you know, the dollar index broke through that inverse head and shoulders neckline, and it really looked like a pretty bullish pattern on the chart. Now, as we're coming back down and retesting, you know, normally when you break a head and shoulders neckline, it keeps going. As it started to roll over and come back, and it just about retested the neckline, it really makes me wonder about how valid that pattern is. And I think it's particularly interesting in the face of Jay Powell's nomination. The expectation for most people is a more hawkish Fed, more rate hikes. You'd think that would be supportive of a continued dollar rally. I took advantage of this opportunity. I wanted to talk to Juliet DeClercq anyway, because we're trying to get her on the program before year's end. So I took this opportunity to say, hey, Juliet, called her up to talk to her about the scheduling. But I said, well, I've got you. What are you thinking these days? You know, it seems like in many ways, Ron Paul's call that, hey, that was a mid-move correction that we saw down. It's going to be off to the races and upside from here. You were the bear on the dollar and seems like it's going against you. What do you think? And she says, oh, no, no, no. I just this week sent out a note to my subscribers reiterating my bearish call and saying now is the time to jump on the bearish dollar trade. And she's recommending the short on the dollar against the euro, Japanese yen, and gold. And of course, she's in Europe, so they think in terms of crosses that way. For people whose investments are denominated in U.S. dollars, what that really means is she's saying buy euros, buy yen, and buy gold, because she sees the dollar weakening. And she says it's interesting. A lot of people are saying that, you know, there was a mid-move correction from 90, from 102 down to whatever it was, 91. Now, you know, it seems to be reversing. She sees it the other way. She thinks the move is to the downside. It got ahead of itself, bounced back up a bit. Now she thinks it moves to new lows below 91, whatever the number was previously. So I only got a little bit of context from Juliet. I really want to get her on the program, both on the dollar as well as on treasuries. She's made some very prescient calls this year. So we'll try to get her sometime in December. In the meantime, what it means for investors, if you agree with Juliet's view, it would definitely be good news for gold investors. I'm still a little bit on the sidelines, but let's try to get Juliet on the program, Patrick, by year's end and see if we can get an update on her perspective.
Well, since we're on the topic of gold here, Eric, gold's now trading around this 1278 level and has literally done nothing for almost a month, just trading back and forth. Are you really bullish here on gold?
Well, I think that what's going on with gold is it's been consolidating because it's waiting to see what is going to happen with the Fed chair position, because that obviously monetary policy plays a key role in gold fundamentals. We've been in this range, low this week, I think it was 1270, high was 1290. We're back in the 1270s again. I've been on the sidelines because I'm waiting to kind of, you know, solidify my dollar view that no follow through in the head and shoulders pattern, even in the face of the Powell nomination, that kind of was a concern for dollar bulls. So my hesitations about not wanting to get into a gold trade were based on a dollar bullish view. And now the data to support that dollar bullish view, it's starting to weaken. So I'm feeling a little bit more comfortable. I have a lot of respect for Juliet DeClercq. She added a long call on gold to her view. Jeff Christian, we had on the program recently, saying, hey, 1260 might very well be the bottom time to buy here. So I think that even if Juliet is right about the intermediate term, I don't think this is the end game for the dollar, where the dollar is going to crash and the end of the world is upon us. So the really big gold trade that I see someday, where gold is the asset to just be super duper overweight, I don't think we're at that stage yet. But in terms of gold being a bad idea because the dollar appreciation was going to continue dramatically, well, we've kind of seen a stumble there, and it came at a time when I wasn't expecting it. So I'm open to either view at this point.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, because crude oil was holding for a week up along that 57-58 level on the upside. And then on Tuesday, we had that drop. We're now trading around this 55-19 level. How deep does this correction go? Was that a top in oil, or is this just the short-term breather and we're going to go and retest those highs?
Patrick, let me start with inventory before coming back to your question about which direction we're headed from here. There was an expectation among analysts of a drawdown this week in crude oil inventory. Crude built instead 1.9 million barrels. Now, it wasn't as big of a build as API had predicted on Wednesday. They said 6 million barrels, but still almost 2 million barrels build on inventory. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 1.5 million barrels. I think they're pedaling as fast as they can to pump oil out of Cushing to make more room because they're nearing capacity. Gasoline building 894,000 barrels. Distillates drawing down 800,000 barrels. So from an inventory standpoint, this was a fairly bearish report. Why didn't we see the price move down immediately after inventory? Well, because API the day before had already priced it in with their expectation of a much larger build. But the question you actually posed, Patrick, is where do we go from here? Is the top finally in, or are we just headed higher? And I think the answer to that is really going to depend on this OPEC meeting. There has been an expectation built into the market that, hey, the production cut to year's end is a done deal. It's in the bag. It's certain to happen. I think that's always been misplaced logic. They need a unanimous agreement for this. This is a time in terms of political tensions when unanimous agreements are difficult to find. And a lot of the statements that have been made, you know, Vladimir Putin, what he actually said was, you know, we're looking at a production extension. Somebody asked him, well, for how long and for how much? He said, look, we're trying to answer the question of whether we need it or not. Never mind how long it should be. Don't put the cart before the horse. So I really don't think it's nearly as done deal as a lot of people thought. It seems like this week we're hearing some statements where the market is coming around to the view that I've had, that it's not necessarily a done deal. Now, if we do get that extension, I think that there is scope to move to even higher highs. Now, I also think that if you look at how just extreme sentiment has become, just record bullishness in petroleum products right now. And if you were to look at what could happen if a market sell-off began, I think it could really unwind. And I also think the rig count has probably bottomed. People don't seem to remember that there's a lag there. All of this hedging, and there's been a massive, massive increase in the swap dealers' commercial short positions. That's where the hedging of producers shows up, because oil producers don't actually sell futures in order to hedge their production. They make a deal with an investment bank, usually a cashless caller, and the investment bank lays that risk off in the futures market. It shows up in the swap dealers column on the commitment of traders reports. So if you look at the huge amount of hedging activity, that's going to go into drilling more wells. So I really think that we have a draft to the downside coming. But you know, Patrick, where I've been wrong in the past on the crude oil market is I see things like that, and I think, well, it's got to result in some down. You know, if we get this production cut extension across the board to the end of the year like people are hoping for, I think it could very easily push us to new higher prices. I don't think they'll last for the next year, but maybe for the rest of this year, I think we could get a push higher on that. On the other hand, what's not priced into this market is no cut extension. Sorry, we're not going to do anything. I think that's entirely possible, and I think that that possibility is underpriced in the market. So we're at a critical crossroads here. I'm either going to soon be proven to have had the right idea, but been way too early in calling for a significant move down, or I'm going to be proven just plain old-fashioned wrong on my bearish calls in recent weeks. I think we're going to get the decisive answer to that after November 30th with the OPEC meeting.
Now, Eric, I got to ask, with everything that's going on in Saudi Arabia and all of these different periphery in the Middle East, the countries that's going on over there, is there a war premium being priced into oil here? Do you think that that's a factor into oil pricing?
Oh, I definitely think that the events in Saudi Arabia contributed to that last push up in oil prices. But in terms of understanding where the risks are, I don't think that there is any imminent, you know, Saudi starts a war or Saudi stops producing oil or anything that takes production offline. The reason I think that premium is coming into the market is there's just a huge uncertainty and instability risk. We know who's in charge of Saudi Arabia right now is King Salman and his son, Mohammed bin Salman. There's a lot of people that, a lot of enemies they just made with this big push to arrest half of the princes in the kingdom. A coup in, you know, hostile takeover of the government could just go in any direction and anything's possible. So I don't think it's a imminent, there's about to be a war. I think it's just a who knows what the heck could go wrong if there was a coup and let's say King Salman and Mohammed bin Salman were executed by other factions in the royal family that don't like them and there was a battle over who's in charge of the country. Anything's possible at that point, and I think that people are reacting to those kinds of tail risk scenarios as opposed to anything imminently occurring.
All right. Well, let's move on to the 10-year Treasury yield, where we were down around the 233 area earlier this morning. We find ourselves now at 237 in yields, literally picked up, wiping out almost all of yesterday's losses. Where do you think yields are going here next?
Well, I still think we're treading water here in the 230s. You know, we've been in the 230s for a few weeks. What I've been saying is let's wait until we see who gets the Fed chair nomination, and at that point, look for a clear trend direction to be established. I'm surprised that we really haven't seen one yet. It's been more than a week since we've known that Powell was the man. And yeah, you know, I don't think there's a trend here. Yeah, we've seen a little bit more movement than we have in the last couple of weeks, but nothing that really says to me a clear direction has been set. I'd really love to get Julia DeClercq's commentary on this. So let's try to get her sometime in December onto the program and go a little bit deeper on it. Personally, I don't really have a strong view on treasuries here.
Thanks for that summary, Eric. Now, for this week's featured interview, HedgeEye founder Keith McCullough will be joining us. Eric's interview with Keith is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program and backed by popular demand is HedgeEye founder Keith McCullough. Keith, last time we had you on the program, everybody and his brother was screaming, hey, the top is in, this is it, the stock market's about to roll over, get out, get out, get out. And you very boldly and confidently told us, look, it's expensive and expensive things get more expensive. That's just how it works. And you were very bullish. And of course, you've been proven right to date. It's so timely as we speak again on Wednesday morning. We've got the equity market down, a few percent. And of course, once again, the chorus is just all over the internet. The crash has begun. It's all over. The end is nigh. It's all coming. What are we down? 3 or 4%, and the world's coming to an end. Where are you at now? Is it time to join the chorus of bears, or are you still on the bullish side of this camp?
Well, thanks for the lovely introduction. It's always good to be, a bull when most people doubt the bullish narrative. What's interesting, actually, the S&P 500, depends on where it finishes today, but as you know, I mean, the correction was literally 60 basis points from its all-time closing high, not just a year-to-date high or some kind of a trending high. I mean, from the all-time, which I continue to remind people is a very long time. And again, if you go back all the way back, and I'm sure we'll review this, all the way back in market history, you'll learn that provided that profits and growth are accelerating, what happens to a quote-unquote expensive market, and I'd argued that it wasn't expensive enough, is that they get more expensive. So at this stage, I think it's less easy. Obviously, we've had an epic move to the upside. The 60 basis point corrections clearly aren't corrections. The ramp, in particular in growth stocks, if you look at the returns associated with either growth as a style factor or just being long the NASDAQ, they've been equally epic. So it begs the question as to what happens next. I mean, a couple of the river cards that I was looking for fundamentally were 3% GDP back-to-back quarters, which we got in both Q2 and Q3. It's unlikely that we get a third here in the fourth quarter, where our predictive tracking algorithm on GDP is currently tracking around 2.5 to 2.6. So it's marginally less great. And on the margin, I think that might matter. The other thing is that clearly earnings, in terms of the easy comparisons of earnings, which was really our call for the last 12 months, they get harder because of the acceleration. And I know that might be a little quirky or geeky to call out, but I think that's a big concern of mine as we go more so into 2018, is that the massive acceleration that we saw in both S&P and tech earnings really has a massive comparison in the first quarter. Of course, that's not reported until April of 2018. So between now and then is Mr. Market's debate on what does and does not matter. And frankly, I think that there's And frankly, not that I wouldn't be frank, but there are a lot of different macro tourist ideas out there on why the market should have always gone down. So I expect to hear and see a lot of those things. It'll be fun to risk manage it or to trade it.
Let's go a little bit deeper on that. You were kind enough to send us a deck of slides to accompany this interview, and I noticed the very first slide that you've got is a statement saying, actually, valuation is not a catalyst. And I think it plays into what you just said, which is it sounds like you do have maybe not a bearish view, but some growing concerns about where various indicators may be headed. But those indicators you're watching are not the CAPE ratio and the other things that are valuation-centric that so many people are obsessed with. So please elaborate. Why is it, if you hear so many experts saying, look at the Case-Shiller cyclically adjusted price-earnings ratio, valuations are the problem, that's what we should focus all our attention on. Why is it that you pay attention to other things and, from what I understand, almost ignore valuations on something like a CAPE ratio metric?
We obviously don't entirely ignore anything that is market history. Market history has a lot of information. So a CAPE ratio, which is a cyclically adjusted P/E ratio, has information within the time series. But don't forget that CAPE ratio in particular is highly levered to the cyclicals. So again, it's a cyclically adjusted P/E. And we had a huge depression in the energy space and or resource-oriented cyclicals. So that's why the E is compressed or low, and the P/E on a CAPE basis looks very high. Now, what happens if oil goes from 30 to 60 is that the E goes up and the market starts to look less expensive. And that's really the point, is if you look at a lot of these valuation experts, I'll call them, and again, I actually, and no undue respect, I mean, I really find it to be a trivial exercise to know the history of peas, whether they be cyclically adjusted or not. That's just history, okay? What you'll also learn, and we can show you in that deck, cartoons notwithstanding, the one that we have on slide 7, where a lot of people answer every question with valuation. They never start with what we start with. And I'm saying they, not being all of they, but I think that the people that have missed major moves, both in terms of expensive markets, quote-unquote, getting more expensive, and cheap markets getting cheaper, is that what they miss all of the time is the prevailing factors of growth and inflation either accelerating or decelerating. So I'm much more focused and always have been on whether growth and or inflation are getting better or worse, not whether they are good or bad. Whether something is good or bad is somebody's opinion. Whether something is getting better or worse or accelerating or decelerating is not an opinion. That's a fact. So again, I deal in the factual space. And the fact of the matter is that there's really no history to suggest that there is a magic market multiple. I mean, if you look at slide 9, I think, of the slide deck that we provided, you know, the question really I ask here, are you sure the market is expensive? Now, you've looked at a lot of different things, but you tell me where in that piece of evidence, going back to 1987, that the black line is discernibly at the spot, the magic multiple, where the market absolutely has to go down. And that's an absurd statement. Only Wall Street could live and get paid on these types of valuation statements. So I'm much more focused on what is driving the black line up and what would drive the black line down. Don't forget that I'm not a perma bull. I'm not a perma bear. I've been plenty short, a lot of down moves in markets. And what I've been focused on is when U.S. growth in particular, in the U.S. stock market's case, start to roll off its cycle peak and slow and then decisively slow. That's when stuff can get cheaper or multiples can compress. But as you can see, if you started shorting the market in 1991-92 when it was right around this P multiple, or in 1996-97 for that matter, you would not be running money if you carried that position for 2 to 3 years after that point, just by being short the market because it was expensive. It's an absurd statement, but only, as I said, only an absurd place, which can be the old wall, can get paid on that.
Well, certainly the 90s proved to us that, as you have said so many times in your past appearance here, expensive things can get a lot more expensive. It was ridiculously high valuations in 97, but guess what 98 and 99 and the beginning of 2000 brought us? I want to come back to your earlier comments, though. If I look at slide 3, you've got a nice graphic that kind of illustrates this point where it says you focus on the slopes. You're not caring about the magnitude of how high or how low we've been, but which direction we're moving in with respect to growth and inflation and so forth. When we had you last on the program, it sounded like we were kind of at max slope. You were just extremely bullish. It sounds like maybe you're seeing a little bit of slowing of those trends since we last spoke. Am I reaching too far to say that?
No, it's just purely time and space makes that happen. So the easiest point to call an acceleration is from the lowest point in the prior year, or at that point on the sine curve. So you always have to ask yourself, and I really think that this is ultimately, it's taken me 2 decades to figure this out, and I'm still banging my head against the wall to get it right. But the reality is that if I can constantly identify within 3 to 6 months where the bottoming process is on that sine curve on slide 3, or the topping process, then I'm going to do better than your average monkey. And that's really my goal. Okay? Got to beat the monkeys. Then I got to beat the market. Now, if I can beat both the monkeys and the market, I'm going to be happy. My clients will be happy. There'll be more happiness than angst. And that's really the point, is that in Q2 of 2016, you were literally at the bottom of the U.S. GDP cycle. You were absolutely at the bottom of the U.S. profit cycle. Don't forget that we were in a profit recession in the U.S. Partly why Trump got elected was in 15 states there was beyond a recession, there was a depression. Okay, so if you need the political analog, you can have it. I don't start and end with politics, obviously. I don't particularly care for politics at all. Incidentally, the political winds had changed given the profit cycle and the economic cycle had slowed into its lows of 2016. Therefore, when we talked, I think we talked at the end of Q2 in June, it was pretty easy to make that call because we're comparing against the low of the cycle. Q3 was also a pretty easy comparison. So as you roll into what was a big acceleration, which was Q1, it finally became clear to people in Q1 earnings season that GDP, CapEx, earnings were all accelerating materially, that the bears had to give up. And that was the first wave. The second wave was that the Bears were offside for all of Q2 and then started whining about valuation. Have you ever heard somebody whine about valuation if they're long of that thing? Never. Try it with your house. Does your wife whine that the house is too expensive? We need to move. We need to leave immediately. There's too much risk living here. This is not the way that life actually works. And it is quite surprising that people think of markets that way. So once we get, my main concern is that it was so good this year that next year you're going to have to compare against that. And that's the main concern. It's just gravity. It's not to say that you can't comp the comps, as we like to say, or compare strongly against a tougher base effect or a tougher comparative base effect period. That's up to Mr. Market and the data. And that's why we run a predictive tracking algorithm constantly, every single day. We get new data. Today we got retail sales. It was up 4.6% year over year, which is a fantastic number, both in rate of change terms and on an absolute basis. CPI back up to 2 year over year. So you have basically inflation and growth rising at the same time. So again, when I change my mind, it will be data dependent. You are quite right, though, in identifying that we're running out of runway in terms of how easy that call was to make in the summer of this year.
Your next slide seems to have a summary of the three macro themes that you're focusing on in the final quarter of 2017. Please give our listeners a summary of what's on your mind here.
Yeah, I think the first one's the most nuanced, if you will. So what we call quad one, quad two, quad three, quad four, that's our four quadrant framework. So we're taking effectively, I think we actually have it on, we have it on slide five here. So you can see this is our framework. So when we're talking about our model, this is our model. You're either in the first quadrant, second or third or fourth quadrant. Now, when you're in the fourth quadrant, that's awful. That's when you have both growth and inflation slowing at the same time, commonly called deflation. So quad four equals deflation. When a central planner sees that, whether it be in the UK or here or in Japan or in Europe for that matter, they automatically go dovish, devalue the currency, create a massive money supply, rainbows and puppy dogs, et cetera. But what they actually get is asset price inflation and a stagflation in the economy. So inflation and asset prices, but real growth is still slow. That's quad three, stagflation. Where we currently have us tracking into the second, or really the first half of 2018, is the first quadrant. So the debate here in Q4 is quad one or quad two, where you get a sequential or a month over month and quarter over quarter rise in inflation. You could see that most easily with oil prices, but you can see it more broadly across the CRB index, which is 19 commodities. You can see it in wage inflation, for example. What we have is actually this 3 to 4 month period where we're trying to debate with our subscribers whether or not it's investable to stay with the reflation trade and for how long. So that's really the first theme. And it's really an ongoing debate. And I think that a lot of things in macro you should debate because they're clearly not easy to nail all of the time. The second one is a very obvious one that we've already discussed, which is where does the profit cycle start to peak relative to the tax reform expectation start to pick up. And I think we're obviously right in the heart of that. So again, tax reform is a tough one. I have absolutely no crystal ball to tell you that this is going to happen with 100% certainty. I'd say that it's better than a coin toss that the market expects some form of tax reform. So if you don't get it, that's going to be a problem. That's not been our call, nor would it be, because I have no data to support that. Again, that might just be a moment in time in the market. So that could obviously be a market risk in as much as it could be a reward. And then finally, the third theme, which I think is probably the most divergent, pardon the pun given that it's called global divergences, but synchronized global divergences, what I'm trying to do is kind of make fun of the consensus out there that is pretty obvious looking in the rearview mirror that we had a globally synchronized recovery. That you can read that in the Wall Street Journal every single day. You can read that from your local consensus economist every other day. That's not what 2018 is going to look like. In fact, China, which is a pretty big part of the globally synchronized recovery, is already slowing. So that's the easiest one to call on the old China part. So that's that. And the south of Europe is a major concern for us. We've already seen inflation rates start to slow across most European countries, and they're certainly lower than the levels of inflation that we see here in the U.S., headline and otherwise. They have no wage inflation in Europe, but we also see consumption growth, retail sales growth in particular, slowing in places like Italy, Spain, Portugal. So we're quite bearish on the 2018 forward outlook on the south of Europe and like I said, China. So that gives you a much different setup from a global demand or a global economic growth scenario than what consensus is currently expecting.
Do you think the Kyle Bass scenario of China having a major credit event that sends a wave of deflation and, creates the next global financial crisis, is there any merit to that? Is that a concern that you pay attention to?
I definitely have paid attention to his work. I always do. A lot of respect for Kyle Bass. I just have disagreed with him, obviously, for the last couple of years, thankfully so, because China, of course, had quite the opposite last year. They had the biggest stimulus in the history of China, which is a fairly long history going back. And you had a major catalyst, which we didn't want to be short of, which was the Communist Congress, which they finally held in October. So, yeah, there are a lot of reasons not to be bearish on China. I think if you're going to make that call, you got to get the timing. He might argue otherwise because he'll just say eventually it's going to happen. That's not tight enough for me. My subscribers would fire me for that. I have to get the timing right within at least a 3 to 6 month window. And the big difference on China, I think, is that they have a closed capital account, and B, they don't have, partly as a function of that, but also more generally, their deposit system on their banks is much different than what we have here in the U.S. So I think if you're going to make the Big Bang USA style credit call, just because we had it and they have incipient signals that would suggest you should be paying attention to the risks, I don't think that that's an event you can time and or structurally you can actually see right away. So that's what we would say on that. What we do focus on, which will help Kyle's case, is China slowing as opposed to accelerating. So again, I always go back to what's the economy doing, in sharp contrast to 2016, and really China's growth peaked in Q1 of 2017. So this year it peaked in terms of the rate of change. So that now we have China slowing. And I think that if Kyle's looking for a real reason, that could be a real catalyst or a causal factor to some negative things happening. Because, of course, bad things happen when growth is slowing. Now he at least does that.
Moving on to slide 6 in your deck, you're saying here long real growth is the macro strategy. That's pretty easy. What exactly do we mean by that? What are the sectors that you want to be in order to participate in real growth?
Well, largely these are the consumption components of the U.S. economy and or innovation components of the U.S. economy, places where you can invest like technology, consumer discretionary, parts of healthcare. So again, this is what the U.S. economy has always been. So when you get a broad-based recovery, these are the core components of the U.S. economy you want to be long if you want to be long real growth. So that's why you see IPOs really have great runs here, companies with high returns on invested capital, high sales growth rates, earnings growth rates. These have all been effectively what we call the style factors within the market that have outperformed and have been up between 22 and 30% for the year to date. So as you can see on the left side of the chart, as I pointed out, U.S. growth bottomed in Q2 of 2016. That's the black bar. Our projections are the blue bars, but those have not changed throughout the year. We've always had a back-end loaded view of U.S. GDP growth accelerating. That, of course, has happened. But to the point of how this looks on a rate of change basis sequentially or quarter over quarter, now the consensus has come to believe this. If you look at the right side, you can see the 3.1% GDP and 3.0. Those are the sequentials. So again, it's almost as good as it gets. I mean, effectively, that's if you want a bear case, it's the best of the bull case is now officially in the rearview mirror for now. But again, this is very data dependent, so you have to update it every day when you get new data.
I think we've talked already about the next few slides. Let's move on to slide number 10, where you're talking about growth accelerating, putting a lid on market multiples. Please elaborate. What do you mean by that?
Well, this one's really easy for people to understand. You should always say this back to the person who's complaining or whining about valuation. Now, I'll be right there talking about valuation when growth is slowing, because that will augment my view. But when growth is accelerating, effectively what the bears have wrong is the E. So if you're going to talk about the PE of the market, whether it's cyclically adjusted or not, just the next 12 months PE, I think you have to have a view on the E. And that's the point, is that what's happened this year is that earnings growth was so strong that you actually didn't see a massive multiple expansion like you saw in the 1990s, at the end of the 1990s. You can see the red line there ripped. It actually ripped in 2009 when we went bullish as well, because people were way too bearish on the E. So again, after the 08 crisis, everyone thought nobody would ever see an earnings cycle again. And lo and behold, that earnings cycle started right around the end of the first quarter in 2009. So you get a big surprise there, and people were still quite reticent to be buying anything if they had any money left. There are a lot of issues there. But we haven't seen some massive multiple expansion, because the E has really been the thing that drove the year. And that's been my point on that.
In the next couple of slides, you're talking about earnings continuing to reflect accelerating growth, where a lot of people are talking about crashing growth and crashing stock markets and so forth. Please elaborate. Talk to the next couple of slides, number 11 and 12.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you can always get people to pay you an advertising dollar, maybe on the back door of it, to click on something that scares you, that we're going to see the end of the world on earnings. But that is clearly not what has happened. So if you look at where we are, we're about 90% of the way through earnings season. So on slide 11, you can see 316 companies in the S&P 500 have reported aggregate earnings growth of 8%. Now, if you go down to the tech earnings growth, that's been 25.5%. That's the best quarter so far. So it's almost a mathematical certainty that by next year in the third quarter that you're not going to have a good earnings season because you have to compare against the 25.5. But what you would have wanted to have been long was the market on the way up to the 25.5. Now, if you look at the NASDAQ, which is the juicier component, which looks a lot more like just tech in the aggregate, you could see that on slide 12. You know, there are parts of this that have absolutely ripped, but the aggregate earnings growth rate of the NASDAQ has been 22 to 23%. So again, it's like I said, it's as good as it gets. When you look backwards, you can always define why you're right or why you're wrong. And hopefully people are honest about why the bulls were right this year. And a big part of that is staring you right in the face there.
Now, the other thing we talked about last time you were on the program was technology stocks, and what people were saying at the time was tech was just way overdone. It's a bubble. It's time to get the hell out before you get burned. And you were very outspoken in saying the opposite. You actually believe technology stocks were the place to be, and so far you've been proven right. So what's going on here? Let's talk about slide 16. What is your counter argument to people who say, look, technology stocks are just ridiculously expensive right now? This is not the time to be investing in them.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, because the first thing I'll say is, oh, so you don't own them. Let's go through that. Why you should have owned them. But what I'll do on the valuation front, because of course I'll start that argument with what growth in both the top line and earnings have actually done in tech, and that's really defined the multiple that you have today. But that multiple, there's two parts to this slide. That multiple relative to the market is nowhere near where it has been multiple times. Now, again, it doesn't have to be, and I say this quite often, which is it doesn't have to be 1999. For God's sakes, it doesn't even have to be 2007. In 2007, our call at the end of 07 was that growth was slowing and the multiple was about to compress. Okay, now that's a good call to make because you got a much higher level of the markets relative tech valuation relative to the market, and you have the causal factor growth started to slow. Okay, so here your growth is still accelerating and the multiple relative to where it's been to the market isn't even close to bubble territory. So that's point number one. The other part in this of this slide, which is I think super important, is within the box, we show where is tech relative to itself. Okay, so it's much more important to define the bands. If you think of the standard deviation of risk of where something can go, I think it's a fair point to start is to say where has it been before on the top end of that, and where is it on the low end? So where, in other words, is tech today on a PE multiple basis relative to where it's been? And it's in the 66th percentile. So it's two-thirds of the way to where it could be. That's another way to look at this. What you'll also note in this box, the real expensive parts of the market are in bond proxies. You know, consumer staples and utilities specifically, if we had REITs, you'd see that too. That's where people really own the most expensive parts of the market. And why were those expensive? Because they're your former growth slowing exposures. And I quite prefer people would approach me with a valuation call like that, because provided that we see inflation and growth accelerating at the same time, those sectors don't do well relative certainly to tech.
Okay, now I feel like I certainly appreciate you've got a very bullish view, and I respect that, but I kind of feel a responsibility to stop you here and say, wait a minute, before we give everybody the impression that you're telling people to go put all of their money into a long-only portfolio of, S&P and tech stocks, I happen to know, because you're a hedge fund guy, you wouldn't be caught dead with a long-only portfolio. So our diehard listeners that have listened to my Accredited Investor Academy already know what a long-short hedge fund strategy is. But I know that what you do at HedgEye, to a large extent, is to teach people how to be their own hedge fund, how to run a long-short equity strategy. And that kind of explains why you can afford to be so bullish but still be hedged at the same time. So for people who aren't familiar with that, please explain. What are we talking about? What is long-short equity? What is that strategy? And why do you recommend that so strongly?
And I appreciate that, because I definitely, that's where I've grown up in this business, and I believe that 100%, because it allows you to not be wedded to a certain style of investing. So, you know, long only, you can be a growth investor, you can be a value investor, you can be a momentum investor, you can be whatever you want to be. But once you decide that that's what you are, you're kind of locked in. Whereas me, I don't care what I'm long or short. I mean, I just want to get the causal factors or the rates of change of growth and inflation right. And if I get those things right, there's always something to be long and always something to be short. So I think it's a much more thoughtful way to be long. Like when you're long, like I am now, long growth, I can be short consumer staples. So I actually am not 100% long the market. I'm short XLP, for example, which is the ETF for consumer staples, and I'm long the Qs, which is the NASDAQ. So I'm long growth, and I'm short growth slowing. It's the same bet, but it's being smarter than what I would be if I was just naked long the market, just trying to talk up U.S. growth until I retire. That's no way to live, at least not for me, given that the market's blown up three times since I started in this business, and I don't want to go through that the wrong way. So that's one way you can set it up, just at a very, you know, at the sector level. Now, once you get into the stocks, I mean, that's why we have 40 people on our research team. God willing, that continues to grow. But I mean, their job is basically to give me their top three longs and their top three shorts every 3 months. So I always have within my macro view and then my sector view, underneath that I have stocks that I want to be long and short. And that's, you know, that's pretty straightforward. I think most people understand that. There are good companies, there are bad companies. Just shorting companies because they're bad doesn't always work. Market timing matters, being in the right sector matters. So we'll break it down. And what you'll find is that there are certain styles that make your longs better in certain environments, and there are certain environments that perpetuate your shorts doing better. So again, that's a good example of that. This year would be something like telecom. Telecom has leverage, negative returns on equity, no pricing power, and competition at the wazoo. That looks nothing like the FANG. So if you're just short a basket of telecom stocks or the ETF associated with that along the FANG, that's another way to express your growth accelerating view in the U.S.
And I just want to make sure we get the essential point in there that you would never consider being just a long-only portfolio of anything. You have a balanced number of long and short positions. So if the market does crash the way some people are saying it could, your shorts hopefully will outperform your longs and you don't lose money even in a down market. So you can make money in either direction of market. That, of course, is the long-short equity strategy that was pioneered by A.W. Jones back in 1949, and which a lot of the hedge fund industry grew up around. So I know a lot of what you do at HedgeEye is actually to teach people how to use that strategy and to offer them potentials for what to have. Because, you know, one of the ways that you can run a long short equity strategy is just to choose sectors. Use sector ETFs for your longs and your shorts, or you can do individual positions. So tell us a little bit more about how you teach construction of portfolios. If somebody is, say, an advanced retail investor, they want to run a long short portfolio. Is it mostly with ETFs and just sector bets, or is it a combination of sectors and individual issues? How would you teach someone to do this?
It's obviously not something that you can teach like you would a moving monkey or a moving average. I mean, anyone can just plug that into their computer and voila, there's your signal. This, of course, takes a long time. It takes an entire career to build a process that is not only beating the market, but also, to your point, protecting during the most important times to beat the market, which is when it's going down. So again, we have a variety of risk management signals that we use. And what you really learn is that you have to have two big things. You have to have the fundamental research process, which we've spent a lot of time talking about today. Again, is it data-driven? Is it getting better or worse? Is it accelerating or decelerating? These are the questions that we ask ourselves every single day. But on the quantitative risk management side, the big question that you're always asking yourself, and we spend a lot of time teaching people, is the relationship not on the simple moving average of price, but on how volatility is affecting that price. So again, there's a tremendous amount of knowledge to be gained on measuring and mapping the volatility of price. Or as Benoit Mandelbrot would have taught back in his day, which I have thankfully learned quite a bit from him, one of the best books I've ever read and kind of the Bible of my process is called The Misbehavior of Markets. And he talks a lot about the measuring and mapping the volatility of volatility. And that's, you know, that's something that we've spent a lot of time teaching. There's, it takes a lot of rinse and repeat. You know, we do this every morning, actually, on what we call the macro show. It's at 9 o'clock Eastern. So we spent a lot of time trying to educate just with live examples of what the market's actually doing now, because that's readily available for people. They can see it in motion. They can apply it to what they're doing. And then, of course, we have products like ETF Pro and whatnot, where we're basically, like to your point, either isolating what we want to be long and short or bullish or bearish of in sector terms or in country terms or in asset allocation terms. And since we're global macro and we do everything from stocks, bonds to currencies, we constantly have a view on all of those things.
Well, and you might be interested to know, too, that one of the five books I have in my head that I haven't gotten around to writing is called Be Your Own Hedge Fund. And the idea was to teach people how to run a long-short portfolio rather than just a long-only portfolio. And I was going to suggest the use of ETFs and sector bets in order to construct it. And when I learned about what you guys do, I said, oh, somebody's already teaching people how to do that, but you do it in a live format. So it's not a book that could be stale, but you're basically giving people updated information, and they can either, you know, there are small products that are just kind of newsletter level all the way up to your full-on product, which is really teaching people start to finish how to run what really is more of a hedge fund style of investing strategy as opposed to a retail strategy. I want to reveal to our listeners the reason it's taken us until now to get you back on the air, because your last interview was very popular. We've had a lot of requests to get you back. When we talked to your marketing guys about getting you back on the show, obviously, you know, you're going to want to pitch your product at the end of the interview, and we let all of our guests do that. It's just a stickling point for me, is I want to get our Macro Voices listeners the very best deal that we can. And frankly, a lot of your stuff is on the expensive side. Your high-end product, which is basically the all-access pass to everything you do, is $2,700. It's not cheap. And we tried to get a deep Macro Voices discount a few months ago, and Dan Holland basically said, no way. You have a corporate policy that you only once a year do the super discount. And so we decided to wait to get you on the program until that. So tell us a little bit about what your Black Monday pass or Black Monday discount is all about. And then I've got even a better deal, because Patrick was able to negotiate an extra $100 off of what I think is your cheapest deal of the year ever on your products. So you've got, I guess it's the All Access Pass is everything you do. Give us the quick outline of what everything you do is. That's normally $2,700. It's $1,000 for this time of year only, and we've got it down to $900 if you follow Patrick's instructions for how to get the discount by using a Macro Voices discount code. What is in that All Access Pass?
It's an opportunity to effectively give people all the tools, as opposed to, you know, people cherry pick tools. They either want the real-time alerts or they want to watch the macro show. But what they'll learn over time if they're using our process the right way is that you need all the tools. I mean, I use all the tools, but we sell them independently. So that's why we do it once a year, just so that we can say, hey, look, if you like how the current components of the process are working, you're going to like it a lot more if you actually use the entire process. Now, the pricing actually, because our research is priced at a premium because we grew up as an institutional research firm, and still 90% of our revenues are institutional research. So, I mean, they'll pay us up to $2 million or more on an annualized basis for all the same, you know, the summary of the tools is what you're getting and how to use them. But, I mean, there's a lot of value, I think, in terms of what we do, because we're effectively giving you the same weaponry that we're giving institutional clients that will only pay us if what we're doing is actually accurate and helping generate alpha. So, you know, again, the all-access pass has things like the macro show, which starts at 9 o'clock in the morning Eastern time, but also the early look note, which is my daily strategy note, and the daily trading ranges, which is again how to buy low and sell high as opposed to chase high and puke low. there's a lot to that, and the macro themes, which is a big part of what we're doing, and constant updates or notes on what it is that could be changing, i.e. where we could be wrong on themes, because we do have a central tendency to change our mind when we're wrong. So those tend to be pretty popular flashes or information, research flashes as well.
So the all access pass, in other words, is if you're serious about this, you're an investor who wants you to teach them how to run their retail portfolio like a hedge fund, including all of the services that give you the menu of ETFs and stocks and so forth for both the long and short side of your portfolio. That's the all access pass. It's normally $2,700. It's $1,000 once a year for the Thanksgiving special. It's another $100 off for Macro Voices listeners. The other thing that you run a special only once a year on, you have a $538 product, which is $269 this time of year. That includes your ETF Pro, Market Edges, and Quarterly Investment Outlook. Who is that well suited for?
Well, that's if you're, I guess, if you're not as engaged in the daily, day-to-day, need to see what's going on in the market every day, need to see every real-time alert, because really the, you know, the IQ product is weekly to quarterly, whereas the All Access Pass includes all the edges that you might have, like the daily macro show, of course, is daily. The early look is daily. Real-time alerts are real-time. So that's not in the IQ product, but the IQ product like has all the ETF long-short selections. That's ETF Pro, to your point, Market Edges, which is strategy, and then the quarterly themes, which is the most important thing that we do. That, of course, is summarized in that product as well.
Okay, fantastic. So the Hedge IQ product, which is less frequent, is a $269 special price this time of year. It's an extra $50 off of that one for Macro Voices listeners, an extra $100 off of the All Access Pass for Macro Voices listeners. To qualify for the Macro Voices discount, what you do is buy the product on the website and then send an email to info@hedgeye.com. Tell them you're a Macro Voices listener and you want the Macro Voices credit applied to your order. And I do appreciate your waiting to come on the show, Keith. We wanted to get you on at a time when you had your best discounts running, because I do like to make sure our listeners get the best deal going. So I want to thank you again for a fantastic interview. We'll look forward to having you back on the program again soon. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Keith. Now, while he did not seem to deviate from his bigger bullish theme, I was personally surprised he offered a more sober perspective on China's growth prospects. You know, I was just reading an article written by Deutsche Bank's Siwei Zhang. He wrote a recent report highlighting the view on China that the risks to watch were all going to become imminent in the next 6 months. The idea behind it is that with Xi Jinping's power being cemented for the next 5 years, it would be the smart thing to do to let the Chinese economy have a hiccup now, so there's plenty of time for recovery over the next 5 years. Nonetheless, what stood out for you in the interview?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting comment, Patrick. And, you know, Kyle Bass has also said it's imminent in the next 6 months. So if Kyle's ever going to be proven right about this China thing, it's probably going to happen soon. As far as the interview, you know, I think that if there's a bullish argument that I've heard that I really have to acknowledge has a pretty sound logic to it, I think that Keith makes a strong argument. Now, personally, I would combine that with what we've said before, which is this is a market where you could have 1987 start tomorrow morning. And I actually read an interesting article this week by a fund manager who says we invest like tomorrow is going to be 1987 because one of these days it's going to be. And it really comes back to what we discussed last week. Use call options or the ratio call spread in order to express that bullish view. So if you wanted to know what to get bullish, I think that Keith makes very good arguments. How would I go about it? And I admit I've been derelict in not having any long exposure to equities because I don't believe in this market. It does make sense to take views like Keith has described here, but I would do it with options so that you have a very contained downside. I don't know when this market is going to dramatically correct or crash, but I do agree that there's very significant risk. It's coming someday. When it does, you want to be able to just, you know, shrug it off and say, hey, all I lost is what I paid for that option premium.
Now, I noticed that you gave Keith a bit more time to talk about his product offerings than we usually give other guests. Should our listeners interpret that as an endorsement for what they offer?
Well, maybe. You know, it depends on what somebody's looking for, and I think that we should clarify that. If you think about the things that are, you know, worth paying for in the marketplace, if you are interested in listening to something like Macro Voices and you want more of it, well, you know, Real Vision is where that is. It's basically interviews with really smart people. We're not teaching classes here on Macro Voices. You do that at Big Picture Trading, but we're not, you know, the Macro Voices program is not about teaching someone to do something. If you are in the position that I was in a dozen years ago, where I wanted to really get serious about investing, reinvent myself as a full-time investor, and do it in a serious way, and start to learn how to run a hedge fund style of portfolio. Well, the ideal thing would be to, you know, find a retired hedge fund portfolio manager or something and hire him to be your personal tutor if you could afford to do that. Essentially, what the HedgeEye product, the All Access Pass is exactly that. They are teaching people how to run their own portfolios like a professional would run a hedge fund portfolio. So Keith is doing a combination of market updates and so forth, but he's also basically teaching this ongoing class about how to organize a long short equity strategy, you know, how to have macro themes and how to structure a process, if you will, of investing. If you are in the circumstance where you are able to spend time every single day on investing, and you know, maybe you're new to doing it on a full-time basis and you need somebody to teach you how to do it, that's exactly what they're there for. It's I think an excellent product. It's normally quite expensive because it's fairly intensive, almost $3,000 a year. And they once a year do a deep discount for Thanksgiving to $1,000, and thanks to your negotiating, Patrick, we got another $100 knocked off for Macro Voices listeners. I think that's a bargain if you are in the circumstance that you want Keith to teach you every single day how to run your retail portfolio the way a fund manager would run a professional portfolio. If you don't have time for that, it's a waste of money. And I think Keith said that himself on the show, because you need to be able to spend time with on your investments every single day in order for it to make sense. So let's move on to our post-game segment. Patrick, what's on your mind this week?
Well, I was going through this week's research roundup, and we included a link to an article from departing J.P. Morgan strategist Jan Lowy. The article was about what he learned after 30 years in forecasting the markets. And when I read it, I thought it was filled with many valuable insights and nuggets of knowledge that our listeners would appreciate. So I wanted to highlight a few of the excerpts from the article, and then we can kind of tie them into what we not only heard Keith talk about, but, you know, where we are in the markets in general today. So I wanted to start off with his first point, and which is that markets are not math or engineering, but are a forever learning and adapting system with all of us observing and participating from the inside. And quantitative techniques are indispensable to deal with the complexity of the financial instruments and the overload of information we face. And, you know, when I read that, it kind of goes back to what I generally have always believed in the markets. You know, when someone becomes an engineer or something like that, they know how much concrete they have to pour for something to hold a certain amount of weight. But those kind of rules don't apply in the markets, because it's an ever-evolving and adapting system that we have to continuously be adjusting in. And I thought he did a great job describing that.
Oh, I agree. And, you know, definitely it's a question of using these tools to understand what ultimately is a game of human emotion. It's fear and greed at the end of the day.
So the second point he goes on to make is, he says, the starting point of finance is this theorem of market efficiency, which postulates that under the ideal conditions, what we all know should already be in the price. So only new information moves the price. Hence, it is the changes in expectation about the future that drives asset prices, not the level of anything. And I thought that really sounded very much in line with what we heard Keith talk about, which is, he's saying, you know, valuations are, it could be expensive, but that's not what's important. It's about the trend of growth and where the data is actually going.
Well, I'm not a fan of the efficient markets hypothesis, but I definitely agree that it is changes in not only expectation, but mood. You look at what happened going up to 2006, 2007. The whole industry was organized around these acronyms like liar loans and ninja loans. They were making jokes within the industry about how ridiculous the lending practices were. But people were still buying those mortgage-backed securities because the mindset at the time was, hey, as long as it's got a AAA rating, you know, I don't care. My bonus check will be cashed. I'm not going to worry about it. There was complacency. And I think it's not just changes in expectations, but it's changes in moods. The mood of complacency is very much in play in markets today. And when it reverses to a mood of fear and panic, it's going to be ugly. But I don't see that reversal really being upon us yet.
Well, absolutely, because behavioral thought is important. It's just what is the mood? Because when we have compressed volatilities and everything is fine, then that feeling of easy money's there and everyone wants to just buy. But it's always amazing to see when those animal spirits shift, right? And that's what even Schiller's work has always been based on. Nonetheless, I want to move on to the third point. And he asks the question, do markets get ahead of reality? And he goes and answers on, says, they do. And yes, exactly. Because asset prices are probability-weighted means and that the reality we perceive is coded into that modal view. Now, before we change our modal view of reality, the market will have seen that change in risk distribution and will have started moving already. And that a kind of an interesting perspective because we've often heard that idea that the market is already discounting the future even 6 to 9 months in advance, right? We don't see the data that the market is already moving on. And it's interesting to put into context that way that, you know, and this is why I appreciate technical analysis and the observation of price action is because often we can start seeing clues in the market about what's happening long before we start getting the news and data that supports it.
I couldn't agree more. That's all I got.
You got. Yeah. All right.
I got something for the next one.
Now, I want to move on to the fourth point, though. And his fourth point goes top down versus bottom up, right? And he goes on and says, as a macro strategist, I naturally think top down, arguing that I sit on top of a tall building, seeing where all the traffic and capital is flowing. But I know that from that high up, I do not see any of the potholes. And that is where I have to rely on my local analysts to tell me what conditions prevail on their street. And they, in turn, ask me, well, what can I see from high up? And I have found that this dialogue between the bottom-up and top-down thinking is what I find most fruitful. I thought that was really a very valuable tidbit of information because this is macro voices. We always take this macro view. And I love macro. I like to look at things from this top-down view. But, you know, when we, let's say, make a top-down view and say financials should do well in this environment, well, you know, we don't necessarily look at, well, which financials are going to do the best. And that's where you need that bottom-up analyst that's looking at all those different fundamentals to kind of answer, well, these ones are doing better than the others. What's your thoughts on that?
You know, this one really, really resonates for me, and I'm not sure if this is what Jan meant, but the way I think about this, you know, I always look at things from the top down because I'm a top-down macro kind of guy. It's my personality. It's what I'm good at. And what he doesn't say here, but I certainly would have said, is not only can I not see the potholes from the top of the tallest building, but if I took the elevator down to street level, I still wouldn't see the potholes because seeing potholes is not my skill set. And I don't think there's anybody who is good at everything. And if there's anything that I've learned about this game, it is to really be honest with yourself and figure out what you're good at and what you're not good at. I'm really good at big pictures. I'm not good at tedious details. So what I do is I rely on other people for that. Even if I were at ground level or had a camera that let me zoom in to ground level, I wouldn't try to read the potholes myself because I'm not good at that. And there's other people that are much better at it. So I try to read the work of other people that are good at the things that I'm not good at and focus on what I know I'm good at. And I think that's one of the most important lessons in investing, what I call the Schwager Doctrine, just because Jack Schwager has written so much about the importance of finding what style of investing resonates with your personality.
I couldn't agree more. The fifth highlight I wanted to make in this report that he put out, and it's the idea of debating a rules-based trading versus discretionary trading. And he kind of looks at it and says, you actually need both. He goes, the question came up naturally whether or not we should just do an investment process driven by a number of empirically proven rules, right? And to banish away any of this discretion or emotional decision-making from the process. And it goes on to say, over time, we converged on a mixture of the two as pure rules ran into the problem that the world is forever changing, partly as everyone else figures out the same rule and then arbitrages away the profit. I love that point, because, and we'll get to that in a second. But he goes on to say, and partly as economic structures and regimes similarly change over time, in a way that we cannot capture with simple rules. Go back to that part where he says it arbitrages away the profits. And this is the problem that I see in the markets today, because as we have this world of internet and everyone using the same types of technical analysis, everyone using the same types of analysis, what happens is that once everyone starts utilizing all the same techniques and it becomes more and more crowded, it actually stops working as effectively and arbitrages all the alpha or benefit that you were able to make with that strategy. And having the flexibility to recognize that and adapt your trading is actually incredibly important. What do you think of that?
Well, I agree. And the other thing he doesn't say explicitly, but I think it's implied here, is if you were trying to be a rule-based systematic trader 20 years ago, you know, there's a lot to be said for that. If you're trying to do just a pure rule-based non-discretionary system, there's computers that are better and faster at it than you are. So I don't see how you can win there. So I see this as really, you know, you've got a couple choices. You can be in the algorithmic trading business and program computers to do the trading for you, in which case you need to be as rule-driven as possible, because that's what is easiest to codify into a algorithmic trading system. Or you need to favor more discretionary strategies that the machines can't compete with, because they don't have that human ability to exercise discretion and judgment. But trying to beat the machines at something that they're better at than you are, that doesn't make any sense to me. And I guess just to wrap this up, Patrick, later in that same article, Jan goes and makes quite a few other interesting points. How long to hold on to a trade, cherishing your errors, learning from your mistakes, spending time with people that you don't agree with. Boy, if there's a mistake that I see in markets, it's people who refuse to listen to people they don't agree with. You want to embrace people who are strongly in disagreement with you so you can learn from them at what you might be missing in your own analysis. So I thought it was an excellent piece overall. I highly recommend it. And again, the link is in your Research Roundup email. For those of you who don't have a Research Roundup email, shame, shame, that means you're not registered yet. And you know, the single most important statistic that helps Patrick to negotiate to get the very best feature interview guests is how many registered users we have at macrovoices.com. So please do your part. Register a free account at macrovoices.com. It only takes a few minutes. We're not going to spam you. We're not going to sell your email address. We're not selling anything. What we will do is send you our free Research Roundup email, which never contains any advertising or marketing. It's simply a compendium of links to a whole bunch of cool stuff, and that would include things like this article that we've just discussed, as well as Keith McCullough's download, his presentation that we discussed today during the feature interview, as well as all of the best free content that we could find on the internet each week. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
In this week's Research Roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview. You're going to find that chart book that Eric and Keith discussed throughout the interview, referencing all the different neat charts that kind of support all of the interesting discussions that you had. There's also the link to the article that we discussed on Jan Lowy, what he learned through 30 years of forecasting. There's also a really interesting article from Jeffrey Snyder talking, you can't hide from the CPI. You'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners who write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. Now, if you have not already, follow our main Twitter account, at Macro Voices, for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter, at Eric S. Townsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.